And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number Car 54. Where are you?
Oh, my.
Right? Remember Car 54?
No, because that's way before my time. But
but you've heard the soundtrack.
But yes,
Car 54. So it's episode 54. That's the point I'm getting at here. This is Cinema Squabble. Who are we? What are we? What do we do? A number of Seattle's film critics, Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters, and Eric Samdahl. You are all here. You are all critics here in the Seattle area. We gather in theaters on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. We chew the fat. We throw insults at each other, generally well-backed and with the kindest of hearts, of course. And now we bring that discussion to you so you can, at home, can listen along and participate and poke fun at us in return. So,
it's easy to do.
Yeah, we've got a host,
a
host of films to talk about this week specifically. Let's talk about some of the stuff that came out last week.
Sure.
And Sarah, you and I already know because you and I already went round and round on this the other day. Zookeeper's Wife. Tell us about this one.
Sure. The Zookeeper's Wife is a true story based on the best-selling book by Diane Ackerman. Tells the story of Polish zookeeper Jan, played by Johan Heidelberg, and his wife, Antonia, played by Jessica Chastain, who was also this film's producer.
Executive producer.
But she went a long way to making sure that this film became a reality.
Yes.
And making sure that there were a lot of women employed mm-hmm. making this film.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, this movie is about two Polish zookeepers in 1939 Warsaw, Poland. And if for anybody that knows their history, 1939 was not a great year to be in Poland, especially in Warsaw, because Germany invades, throws all of the Jews into a ghetto, and you don't have to, I mean, you need to know your history just a little bit, but you should have a good idea of what happens next, especially to Jews that were in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
The story here is that Antonia and Jan, they convert their zoo into a pig farm. They do this so that they can hide Jews in the old the underground cages and runways and tunnels that connected the entire zoo together until they can connect with the resistance and shepherd them out of the country.
So basically a underground railroad for Jews trying to get out of Warsaw in 1939, 1940.
Exactly.
Yep.
And in the process between over the course of the entire war, the two of them saved just over 300 lives and only two people that came into their care were killed. That is no.
Right. But that was after they had already left the zoo. So they were back out in society.
Yep. And it was their own, I mean, in all honesty, it sounds like it was their own mistake, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Sadly. So the movie is directed by Nikki Cairo, who did Whale Rider and most recently McFarlane USA. And it's an extremely well-directed film. It's also scripted by Angela Workman, whose most notable screenplay is Snowflower and The Secret Fan. So there is a little bit of an imbalance here between the screenwriting and the direction, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It is a movie that I kind of loved coming out of the theater, but one that I had little nitpicks that kind of grew on me more and more as I thought about the film. Now, that said, I think Chastain is wonderful. I think the movie's subtlety is its hallmark, that it doesn't really push the fact of what is going to happen to these Jews in the ghetto. You know that. It doesn't need to oversell.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to pull at tear ducts in a false melodramatic fashion. I really responded to the act of heroism on Antonia's part and how she kept orchestrating this plan. Places where I think it falls a little bit short is, so Daniel Brühl plays a zoologist from Berlin.
But he is a Nazi.
Who ends up having to take over all of the activities going on in Warsaw and overseeing them.
And he's going to create the oxen for the master race.
Which he really tried to do.
Yeah.
Nazi zookeepers are the worst. They really don't get their time in the movies, but they were notable for
the
worst of all Nazis.
Early on, I think he gives a wonderful performance. I think there's some really great chemistry between him and Chastain. But about halfway through the movie, suddenly Brühl kind of turns into that stereotypical movie Nazi and really goes more over the top and in sort of like a snidely whiplash fashion than is necessary. There's also a subtle little plot point about Jan being jealous because Antonia is having to keep Daniel Brühl's Nazi on the hook, and she's using every trick she has to keep him from noticing what's going on in the zoo. And some of that doesn't work particularly well.
Yeah,
but I think the core story always works, and I really responded to it. And I it's heartfelt, it's honest, and it doesn't try too hard. Mm. And so for that reason, I just really do enjoy the film quite a bit.
Okay. Yeah, it does not try hard enough.
That was where I was going to come in, Eric. Exactly. Do you have more to say on this, Eric?
Yeah, I like the movie. Like Sarah, I watched it. I enjoyed it. I didn't maybe love it as much as she did coming out, but the same kind of nits sort of grew on me as I came out. To me, I just did not care about any of the characters all that much. I didn't feel much emotion at all, which I think is a failure on the part of any Holocaust-related movie. Mm-hmm. They have some ghetto scenes, and they're, you know, sort of, there's bad stuff happening, of course, but I just didn't really think that it worked all that well in terms of eliciting the emotion that it needs.
Yeah.
Jessica Chastain's character, probably for the sake of, mounting everything into a climax, does some stupid things towards the end that results in everything that goes down at the end to have an exciting Hollywood finish that I was like, I don't really care if she gets shot at this point. Her little son, honestly, does so many stupid things. I was like,
this kid's asking for a bruising.
Yeah. So it was all right. It's a second-rate Holocaust movie.
Yeah.
And for that reason, you know, there's a reason why nobody's heard of it.
And I think that's exactly where I'm coming in on this. This thing made about $3 million over the weekend.
Box office has nothing to do with quality.
Well, but $3 million in 541 theaters.
Which is actually really good. It's considered a box office success, and Focus is expanding it into more theaters this weekend because it did so well last week.
Yeah, I think it's going to tank after this week, though, period. Just out of the fact that
also got an A cinema score.
Yeah, but touching on what Eric's getting in here, I felt very little moved by Chastain's performance exactly. I don't feel anything towards any of the characters here. And as far as Holocaust films go, the parts that emotionally connect with the audience, I'm watching this and I'm looking for things. I'm looking for something that's going to move me like Schindler's List. I'm looking for something that's going to move me like The White Ribbon. I'm looking for something that's going to move me like The Boy in the Pajamas, The Striped Pajamas. I'm looking for something that's going to reach out, grab my heart, squeeze it, and make me actually feel something.
So you like melodramatic excess. You like movies that go over the top. You like Douglas Sirk, let's pull tears and make it as false as possible.
See, I thought this was as false as possible in the sense that it was actually playing things down. It played it so flat and to the point where it was on the nose. There's a scene where an eagle is killed on screen. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving any major plot point away by this.
No.
An eagle is killed on screen basically as a representation of, look, it's the U.S. All right. And that, by the way...
Well, that, you're reading into that. You don't know that for sure.
Barely. Barely.
I would fathom a bet.
No, BS. That's supposed to represent
bald
America.
Eagle.
Bald eagle. They could have chosen any other ornithological species, and it would have worked just fine. You could have put a penguin in there, and it would have been the same thing. They chose an eagle, Sarah.
That actually would have been more heartfelt had it been a penguin.
Cute. My point is then that same eagle winds up stuffed in the zoologist's office, and it's waved in front of our nose there is so much on the nose in this, and it is so overly melodramatic that it actually falls in laughable to the point where I'm going,
how can it not be melodramatic and be overly melodramatic at the same time? You just contradicted yourself.
Not at all.
That makes no sense.
It is melodramatic to the point where you're going, really? I'm supposed to feel this? And yet, it's not grasping the emotion that it actually needs to be getting. There is one scene and one scene alone that sticks with me, and it's as children are being loaded onto a train. And that is the sole and only scene that rings true and actually makes, I think, the audience feel something, because we feel something for these children. But aside from that, and Steve Reeder would agree with me on this because we talked about this later, the score overdone, and we did not agree with the score choicing. We felt that didn't even actually, it was misused and misplaced and didn't actually evoke or conjure emotions for us. In fact, draws attention to itself. The production is fine, but I think the editing, they cut their punches short. We see an entire zoo annihilated. We don't see any animals actually. It's like watching the A-Team. Did you ever watch The A-Team and realize nobody's ever shot on camera? Nobody's ever dying on screen? It's implied violence and it's implied death, but we never see any of that actually happen.
Well, that's not entirely true. You see an elephant actually killed. And you get to see dismembered animals being thrown into a pit where their legs and their... You get to see a lot of aftermath.
We have watched an entire Warsaw Zoo, and we have seen zero animals. Actually, it is implied violence, but it is not followed through. It is a pulled punch 100% of the way.
Totally disagree. It's also a PG-13 film where they're trying to get the broadest audience possible because they want actual kids to be able to see this movie.
A PG-13 film with bare breasts twice.
Yeah, so who cares?
If I was 13 seeing bare breasts in a film, I would have... Wow.
But then you didn't watch enough movies, because when you were 13, bare breasts actually got by the MPAA to be a PG-13 movie.
Never saw them.
Doc Hollywood opens with breasts staring right at you for 15 minutes. That's actually not true. It's more like 5 minutes. But still, I mean, that's a movie that today would be an R-rated film because you have one of the longest nude scenes in any PG-13 film. Barbarella is rated PG, and Jane Fonda... in a movie about sex, is naked for like a quarter of that film.
Boy, I tell you, if we knew about that when I was 13, Sarah, it would have been a different ballgame. But unfortunately,
you just didn't watch movies.
The excitement for us was watching half a boob in The Fly, the recreation. Anyway, wow. I digress. The point is, I found this film to be absolutely flat. And as far as a heartfelt and heart-wrenching, it was more of a heart-pinching. I give this one a skip altogether. Zookeeper's Wife. Eric, where do you come in on this?
So I stayed silent because that was fun watching you guys go back and forth, even though it got a little chilly in here. Just a little chilly or really hot. I'm not sure. But I mean, we started talking about boobs and stuff, but I'm going to go with rental.
Okay.
I think it's a theater. I mean, I don't think it's a strong theater. I do have reservations, but I think the performances are really good. Mm-hmm. I think the emotions are pure and strong, and I think it's a story that needs to be told.
Mm. All right. So we are split three ways on Zookeeper's Wife, which brings us to a French film by the name of Raw. Now, this out, you can find this, I believe, at, is this at the Uptown still?
Opens at the Uptown.
Opening at the Uptown? Yeah.
Was playing at the Uptown. Wasn't it playing at the Egyptian?
It may be. It's going to be a smaller film or a smaller theater, regardless of what we're talking about here. But Raw, this is the general gist of a young French girl who heads off to veterinarian school. She's a vegetarian. Her whole family appears to be vegetarian. Mom, dad, now daughter, appear to be vegetarian. She goes to this veterinarian school and is kind of engaged in a bizarre hazing of the freshmen. And part of that, even though you're at veterinarian school, is to take a little nibble of a part of some rabbit flesh or some other meat raw that they have kind of just given to you. And being a vegetarian, she's, no, I don't want to participate. But her big sister is there and says, oh, come on, get over it. Just do it. You don't want to be the laughing stock of your class. Eat the meat. So she takes the nibble and then feels totally sick, but then realizes a little bit later, amidst all of this teen angst, by the way, she's the prodigal veterinarian student. She's the one with hope. They're looking at her as, wow, you're going to be the Einstein of veterinarian sciences. Suddenly starts getting this hankering for meat. And this meat starts taking on, it's not just like cooked meat. It's not like hamburgers. It's raw meat. And this takes on a very cannibalistic tone. I'm going to leave it at that. This is a gruesome and horrific look at sexuality, addiction,
teenage angst, coming of age.
Yeah, so
maturity,
many things all wrapped in one.
Peer pressure.
This is not a simple film to look at. On its face, it looks very straightforward. But I think once we get into subtexts of what's going on here, this takes what the Neon Demon was aiming for and really punches you square in the face.
Well, but the Neon Demon was a little bit different. I mean, this is more of a cannibalistic Mean Girls, if you want to get technical.
Sure. I'll go with that.
It is a movie about cliques and about peer pressure, but it also mixes in exactly what you're talking about. You know, that self-discovery, learning who you are, sexuality, gender, all of that sort of stuff gets mixed in as well. The movie is perversely funny at times.
It really is.
It really is it's almost a comedy at moments, which, I mean, in a movie about eating raw flesh, you kind of have to have some humor in there.
Right, right.
But it's so dark and so brilliantly disturbing, especially the way that it just gnaws right into our main character's soul.
Written and directed by Julia Ducournau, by the way.
A young French woman, up-and-coming filmmaker. She's going to have a fantastic career. Cannot wait to see what she does next. It is a masterful, insidious, really smart little movie that I've watched twice, and I can't wait to watch it again.
Yeah. The tonality, to me, in this, and the textures that we get in with this as well visually, a lot going on here to just kind of soak in and feel uncomfortable with.
It's one of the most beautifully uncomfortable 99 minutes I've spent in a theater this year.
Yeah. Eric?
Interesting. So, for the record, I watched this movie a week before putting on a 300-person conference. So I was a little distracted.
Right, right.
A little home. And I watched it at home.
What did you serve at the conference?
Oh, there was a secret sauce. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
But all this texture and nuance, which I've been told over and over, went right over my head.
Okay.
Went right over my head.
Okay.
I thought it was entertaining for the most part.
Yeah.
It was fine. I didn't find it that grotesque or that riveting or that beautiful. I thought it was well directed, well written, well acted, all the components of a good movie. But I might see it again because I promised Matt at Silver Screen Riot that I would, because he described it as hilarious.
Sure.
And I'm like,
where's the hilarity?
I did not laugh once during the movie.
Right.
And then you guys are making me feel extra stupid by speaking to the subtle nuance of the teen angst underlying the entire movie. But it was okay. I don't think I'd recommend it to the masses.
Where do you sit on horror generally? Where does that on the spectrum of things you enjoy? Do you seek out horror?
I seek out horror. I'm not like going to watch every trashy horror movie and crazy horror movie. So I'm not.
You're not me.
I'm not Sarah.
You're allowed to say it. It's okay.
I'm not Sarah. But the last couple of years I've loved, because it's been a great couple of years for horror.
Yes, it has.
I would not put Raw into that upper tier.
Out of curiosity, anything offhand, like what's the first one, if I say great horror flick, recent, what comes to mind?
The number two movie of 2016 for me was The Witch.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
Green Room almost made it.
Huh. Green Room almost a year ago.
And I loved Get Out.
Yeah.
Get Out is definitely making my top 10 list, unless the second half of this year just surprises me.
Okay. So we are really on, I think, a very similar page. Sarah would probably put It Follows in there as well, right up on that same.
Too.
I have a bunch. I mean, The Devil's Candy, which I talked about on the last show, I would put up there right now. I think that's phenomenal. And there's some other things that I've watched that I would put up there, but, you know.
Okay.
That's me.
All right. So where are you coming in on this one, Eric? I mean, because Sarah and I are kind of leaning obviously towards one direction. Where
obviously.
Are you theater Rent, Skip? I mean.
Rent.
Okay.
And for the theater people, it's still playing at the SIF Egyptian.
At the Egyptian?
The Egyptian Theater on Capitol Hill.
The one they saved.
Yes.
Actually, they saved them all, but this one's the most recent save.
Yes.
So, and Sarah, where are you coming
theater. Out? Theater. See it at the SIF Egyptian.
Yeah.
Please, go support SIF Cinema.
Right. And then go have sushi across the street.
And definitely.
You could do that.
I guess actually you could.
You could. You could have some raw meat across the street. Get it?
Eh?
Raw.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where you would go.
You know, Adam, you're
there's a Blue Sea Sushi across the street, like Kitty Corner on Broadway.
Oh, that's new. I didn't know that.
I believe it's between like Einstein Bagels and your Mod Pizza. There's a sushi joint in there somewhere. I walk by it every now and then.
Good, look at that. We're just telling people to go everywhere today. Yeah.
So, Adam, your summary of the movie at the beginning reminded me of when I was in college. I had a college roommate who was a vegetarian.
Yes.
She didn't really like vegetables that much. Like, she loved the smell of meat, but she, out of, you know, principle or whatnot, was not a meat eater.
How's that work if you don't like vegetables and you don't like
meat? Yeah, she just ate sort of crappy food.
Eat beige.
You know, it was not the best diet. But anyway.
It's my sister. So, she does the same thing.
Yeah. So the great thing about when people are in college, they often don't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
So one of my crowning achievements in life is me having a little bit more money than she did. I offered her $50 to eat meat. Which she took me up on, and she's never been a vegetarian since.
Oh, wow. Did you go full hamburger helper, or what was the carrier virus?
I made her chicken, and also me being a college student, I wasn't a very good chef, so it wasn't very good chicken, but I guess it was enough to get her over the edge, and then it was all downhill or uphill.
Well, at least you started with the chicken, though. That's a little heart healthy, so good choice on that.
Depends on what kind of chicken.
Right. Going... In Style.
Going in Style is a remake of a 1979 classic directed and co-written by Martin Brest, mm-hmm. who you will remember from Midnight Run, Beverly Hills Cop, and...
The original. The original is done...
What? The original film was co-written and directed by Martin Brest, who mm-hmm. made Beverly Hills Cop, Midnight Run, Son of a Woman, those movies.
Yeah.
Great director, great filmmaker. Starred George Burns, Art Carney, and this is the one that always surprises everybody... Lee Strasberg, who nobody ever remembers was an actual actor. They just think of him from like the Strasberg studio and teaching other great actors how to act, like Nicholson and Pacino and all that. They forget that he was an actual professional actor too.
Sure.
This remake is oddly directed by Zach Braff.
Very weird.
That is weird.
Oddly written by Theodore Melfi, who we just saw Hidden Figures from. Mm-hmm. And stars, not so oddly, Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, and Alan Arkin in the roles originally played by Burns, Carney, and Strasberg.
Right. And oh, by the way, can we pause for station identification?
Of course we can.
Did you know that if you say Michael Caine's name, you say my cocaine. You say my cocaine. It's actually saying Michael Caine's name with his accent.
Oh, well, there you go.
My cocaine.
I learn something valuable every day. Yes,
there you go. These are the facts that I just walk around with.
That's awesome.
So it's Michael Caine.
So the next time they do a trip Morgan sequel, Freeman. You need to be on there, is what you're saying. Because then you can talk about Michael Caine along with Steve Coogan. Okay. That said, Going in Style is about three retired U.S. steelworkers who discover that their pension is basically being stolen by their company and by the bank that is going to be overseeing the merger of their company with another another business.
Mm-hmm.
So they come up with the idea that they are going to rob that bank and get their pension back.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically 80 years old. They're basically in the twilight of their lives. They've been good upstanding human beings for all of their lives. They have no idea how to rob a bank, and yet they're going to figure it out and they're going to rob the bank.
Mm-hmm.
That is the movie. There's other little things going on here and there. I mean, you know, Michael Caine's got a granddaughter played by Joey King, and then you know, Morgan Freeman might have a health issue, might not. Who knows?
He's got a granddaughter.
Alan Arkin is romancing Anne Margaret.
Who still looks great.
Who still looks amazing. Mm-hmm. We figured this out the other day, though. So Anne Margaret, if you remember, played Walter Matthau's girlfriend in
Grumpy Old Men, way back,
you know, back in the 90s. And she was like 30 years.
She would have been in her 50s then.
Yeah. She was almost like 30 years younger than Walter Matthau at that point.
Mm-hmm.
She's basically playing Alan Arkin's girlfriend here. She's still over a decade younger than Alan Arkin.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hey.
She's got longevity.
I guess. It's like everybody's just going to keep casting her to be the romantic interest of these legendary screen icons.
Yeah.
That's what she's been doing for the past 20 plus years, but I do love the fact, so getting off on a total different tangent, I love the fact that they do let Anne Margaret sing because it's been a while since we've seen got the opportunity to see and hear Anne Margaret sing in a film, and even if it's just karaoke and even if it's just for a second, it's still awesome to see Anne Margaret up there on a stage belting it out like she's standing next to Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
Okay, that aside, this movie is really simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's really straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that happens that you do not expect to happen, and the only reason it's worth watching is because the three stars, plus Anne Margaret, plus to a lesser extent... John Ortiz, who plays a mysterious
pet shop guy
who takes these three geriatric wannabe criminals under his wing.
Yeah.
If not for them, this movie would not probably be worth the time of day, but they all give a lot more to the film than the film arguably deserves.
Even Matt Dillon's bit part, which I kind of looked at you and I said, wow, Matt Dillon's still working. And you're like, well, he's done a lot of TV. I'm like, well, I don't watch TV. But okay.
Nobody is phoning it in.
Right.
Now, that said, nobody is doing anything other than Michael Caine is playing the Michael Caine part.
Right.
Morgan Freeman is playing the Morgan Freeman part. Alan Arkin is playing the Alan Arkin part.
Yeah.
it's totally harmless. Yep. And if you're in the demographic that is interested in this film, mm-hmm. you're going to have a good time. If you're not in the demographic that's going to enjoy this film, you're going to watch it at home and be mildly surprised, yeah. but you're not going to go to the theater to watch it. It is not going to have the longevity of the original. Mm-mm. It is not going to have the awards prospects that the original had. Mm-hmm. And as much as I like Zach Braff, it's not going to do for his career what it did for Martin Brest way back in 1979.
Or what Garden State did for Zach Braff, yeah, what, 15 years ago now, practically?
And I'm going to make an ageist comment, but sure. if you're in the demographic for this movie, you probably don't even know what a podcast is because...
Unless you're our parents.
You have to be old to really appreciate the tired old people jokes that have been around for the last however many decades yeah. that... You know, it's like,
and there aren't new. None of the jokes are new.
They are not new at all.
I will say the one thing in the movie, and it's been a long time since I've seen the original, so I can't really remember if the character is the same. The one thing I will say that did annoy me about this film, that irked me about this film, that kind of made me a little bit angry about this film, Christopher Lloyd plays one of the supporting characters.
Body, 1.21 gigawatts.
Yeah, and not only does the movie completely waste him.
Absolutely.
It throws him into a role 52. That if I'm... In my late 60s,
come on,
early
give me some
70s.
Credit for this, Christopher Lloyd.
You're doing
come
pretty
on.
Well there. I'm good. I'm impressed. But you know, if I'm in the demographic, I may be offended because it's a really horribly written character that just isn't funny.
I disagree. See, having spent a lot of time around the Milwaukee Catholic home with my grandmother, I have seen the Christopher Lloyd character sure. personified. Actually, I've seen not he's personifying what I saw there.
And I don't doubt that, but yeah. I mean, but the character is just there to be ridiculed and laughed at. There's nothing redeeming about that character. Sure. There's nothing about that character that tugs at your heart. He's just there to be laughed at. And both I think Christopher Lloyd, who just turned in a magnificent performance, speaking of horror movies, in a British film from last year called I Am Not a Serial Killer that got him a BAFTA nomination,
right,
is still a brilliant actor when he's given the opportunity, yes. and it wastes him so just. But yeah. I mean, that's a completely different tangent.
I wouldn't go to the extreme of calling it offensive, but I definitely was like, wow, this is just. It was even just a really bad representation of somebody who's really senile. Yeah. Like, I think it actually would have helped to have a no-name actor. Just find some old person who's willing to act. Because he was, like, over the top in a bad kind of way.
Yeah, talent's definitely gone to waste.
Yes.
I will agree with you on that. But at the same
point...
And
again, I say offensive for the demographic. Maybe. Potentially.
You go hang around at the Seattle Elks. No. You might have a different story to tell.
Yeah, I don't... My grandfather is a member of the Elks. I've hung around at the Elk Club way more than...
So there, or Friends of Eagles, or
that too.
Pick the Kiwanis.
Yes.
You know, any group of, large gathering of men. The funny thing about this was when all of us walked out of the theater.
That was hysterical.
So there's a PR rep who's sitting there trying to take notes down, ask us for our first reactions.
I came out first.
Sarah comes out first, and she says, Sarah, what'd you think? Sarah, what was your answer?
It was harmless.
Mike Ward comes out. Mike Ward, what'd you think? His response.
It was basically harmless.
It was basically harmless. I walk out completely unprompted. We have not talked. We have not said word one.
Nope.
Coming out of the theater. Adam, what'd you think? It was harmless. 3 in a row. I don't know if that's ever been done before.
Well, it certainly took her off by surprise. I don't think it ever happened to her.
I led with old people will like it, but it's pretty harmless.
See? I think that's kind of the sum of it, the sum of the parts
that
on
is
that
the
one all together.
That sums up this movie perfectly.
Yeah. It's fun. It won't hurt you.
It's a rent.
It's, yes. Sarah, I will agree with you on that. This is a rent. Eric, where are you coming in on this?
Skip. It is harmless, but there's no reason why anybody needs to even spend $5 or 90 minutes of their life, which I felt the movie actually felt longer than
the running time.
It did.
There's no reason why, with all the movies out there, you should even bother renting
it. You know what's funny is it's actually a minute shorter than the original.
Is it really?
Yeah.
And looking at the clock when I walked out of there, too, I thought to myself... Well, geez, it came in here. I don't know what fat I would necessarily trim from this either.
No, because there's nothing there.
Yeah. So there's that.
You know, I can't really disagree with Eric, but what I would say is not so much Rent. Uh-huh. It's the when it it's the kind of movie that when it comes on cable mm-hmm. and you're folding laundry,
yeah.
this is the movie you will watch.
I'd
and you will have
that.
No problem whatsoever
it's
doing
harmless.
This.
Yeah, it's
I'd agree with that.
Okay, so there's uh-oh. Also this little big film that happens to be kind of looming in theaters right now. It's kind of science fiction-y. It's kind of what's going on here. A lot of folks.
Oh, it's The Boss Baby? That was a big hit from
right,
last week?
Right, Boss Baby. That's a good one.
Oh, no, okay.
What was the other one? Was the other one Smurfs? Was that
That's
also?
This week.
That's this week? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so a couple animated
pretty
films.
Pretty good.
Huh.
Weird.
Well, I think you're the only one of the three of us that had a chance to catch up with either one of those.
No, that wanted to catch up with either one of those. Let's clarify.
Correct. Now, Eric, you had a chance to see this. Sarah, you had a chance to. I am in the dark in this. I haven't seen the original of this in nearly 20 years.
It was 1996.
We're talking Ghost in the Shell. This is a recreation.
Yeah. So, 1996 animated film has now been turned, which in turn was based on a manga series, has been turned into a live action adaptation starring Scarlett Johansson, directed by Rupert Sanders, best known for Snow White and the Huntsman, and for having an affair with Kristen Stewart while filming that movie.
Oops.
And the movie is essentially set in Japan in the future, where humans and technology have been merged more and more. So humans get technological implants to enhance themselves. Mm-hmm. Scarlett Johansson is essentially a full-on cyborg with a human's brain in it. And she plays a cop who is on a special government squad, I guess. They never really do a great job of explaining it.
Section 9.
And they are hunting down this dude who may or may not be a dude, but some kind of elusive figure who is killing off scientists in the corporation that created Scarlett Johansson's character, renamed or shortened to Major in this movie. And as we'll get into it in a little bit, the movie, which cost over $100 million to make, set in Japan, notably stars almost entirely white people.
That's not the main characters. It's actually a very diverse. The casting is very diverse in this movie.
Oh yeah, yeah. The other 100 extras and like two people who show up to ramble about something or else. They might be of Asian descent. The people who get 90% of the dialogue, white people.
Let's be fair. So there are four main white cast members, and they are the primaries.
Okay,
but the entire Section 9 team. They're all diverse and they're all from everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not just an Asian there. There's people from every, they cover all of their bases. Their team is led by Japanese legend Beat Takeshi Kitano, who, if you know who that is, he's basically the Japanese Clint Eastwood, but even more so in that he's not just a writer, director, actor. He's also a painter and a musician. And more than likely, he's probably written like 75 books and he probably does macrame on the side. I mean, the guy is a legitimate
Renaissance man.
Yeah, and he does it all. And if you've ever watched any of his films, he's phenomenal.
Okay.
Just a genius. The weird thing about the movie is that it is really diverse as far as the casting is concerned, and yet the four of the five main people that we listen to throughout the entire movie are Caucasian.
Yeah, nothing Sarah said refuted any of the quasi-facts that I laid out for the record.
I'm just saying, I mean, it's...
Yeah, I said 90%, you're right. Four out of five would be 80%, so...
It goes beyond that.
Okay.
Yeah, the villain is white. The corporate CEO is white,
But now, okay.
Yeah.
But let's
let's get down to brass tacks on this.
Coming down to the... So I definitely fall into the camp of if the movie's good, regardless of the casting, I ultimately don't care that much. Mm-hmm. And I was entertained throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. I was generally into the story, which is, I mean, Rupert Sanders, Snow White and the Huntsman... Beautiful film, a lot would say is a very hollow film in terms of it looks great. There's not a lot of substance to it. This movie falls into the same camp. Looks fantastic. It looks like a music video.
I was going to say,
a lot of the time.
It plays like a Clint Mansell music video. Whose score, I mean, the Clint Mansell, I think, is Lauren Baffa combined to do a score. The score is extraordinary, and there's a large portion of the film that just plays like a music video for the composers.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. But you know, it's alluring, and the story's pretty fascinating for a while, and then you realize there's just not a lot of meat to what's going on here. And they have changed. I don't really remember anything about the original, but I did look it up on Wikipedia afterwards, and they've changed a lot.
Yeah.
But it's just, it seems like there's a lot of substance, and then you realize there isn't, and you're like,
yeah.
And so I found it entertaining. I think the average person will probably be like, it was all right.
Right.
But okay. You know, it's sort of an empty vessel.
They have reworked the source material considerably. There is a certain point in the movie where you realize it's more of a buddy cop movie between Scarlett Johansson and her second in command, Batu, played by Pilou Asbeck, than it is anything else. I liked him too, and they have great camaraderie together, but I would much rather watch them in a Black Widow movie working in tandem on that team than I would in this movie working in tandem. They do it. They have great chemistry. They look fantastic together on screen. They perform well together in action scenes.
So
it just feels like they're in the wrong movie to be doing a lot of the things that they are doing inside this movie.
What's the real hang-up? Because, Sarah, when I didn't actually read your review, but I read your headline on the review, which was like, this is very flashy, but it's a travesty. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, something horrible.
Sarah went social angry on this one.
I did, and I don't normally, but the movie kind of, in some ways, asks for it. And it's a broader conversation, and we've had this conversation before, especially most recent when we talked about Doctor Strange.
Yes.
So the movie came under fire immediately when they started filming it for whitewashing. Mm-hmm. You know, Scarlett Johansson is playing a Japanese role.
Okay.
The character in the manga, the character in the anime that is a Japanese character.
Who is particularly white in the actual animation.
Sure.
Who looks particularly Caucasian in the original animation.
Well, I mean, you know, because the idea is that she's, again, it's a shell and it's,
and
you know,
she's
still her heritage and all that sort of stuff.
And she's merged. Yes. I mean, this is where all societies have merged, as I recall, right?
Yes.
So we've got kind of no race anymore.
But if you are coming from a Japanese perspective, this is a piece of classic literature and animation for you.
Okay.
Also, this is part of your heritage.
Also, they do
cinematic.
Had they cast the film in a way where there was like Asian people and white people and all different races all over the place and didn't make it seem like you were truly just in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just feels like you're in Japan and you have these white headlining characters and then almost everybody else are non-white.
Mm-hmm.
If you had truly mix that all together, then you could have established that, hey, this is a post-racial world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this live-action version does that.
It is bizarre in that, because I actually would love that you bring up that point, because whenever they're walking around Japan or they're talking, or again, like when we just talked about the Section 9 team, that whole idea of a post-racial Japan, it's all there, and yet the four primary people that we keep dealing with are white. And the two main people at the corporation, the Honka Corporation, is the white scientist played by Juliette Binoche and then the white CEO. So it feels like it's like a 1950s representation of what a diverse society would look like, in that the society itself is very diverse, but it's still run by white people.
Yeah.
It's just a stupid PR move, like stupid casting, and that they didn't catch this early. You know, I don't feel as strongly about whitewashing as some. Again, if it's a good movie, I'll get over it. But the fact that in this day and age they did not catch this early on, and they're paying the price for it.
Well, and I think what they're paying the price for is not so much that stuff. Well, I think that does play into it. There is a twist in the film, and this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler alert, because we can't really go into this conversation without talking about it in some respect. So the movie had two choices. It could either take the Doctor Strange angle and just present the character as is. So that movie, you had Tilda Swinton portraying a traditionally Asian character, and the movie just said, this is Tilda Swinton, she's playing this character, That's it. Mm-hmm. And it just let it be. Now, the filmmakers talked about it afterwards. They took ownership. They said that they maybe could have thought about it differently. That's a different conversation. But the movie itself, it just put the cards on the table and said, this is what we've done. This is where we're at. Take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. They could have done that, and they probably should have done that.
They don't.
But they don't do that.
Okay.
There is a fairly significant plot twist in the film where you realize where the brain that is now in this shell that is Major mm-hmm. has come from. Hmm. And when that happens, it presents a really interesting theory. It presents something that if the movie would have wanted to spend 5 minutes, just 5 minutes talking about it, mm-hmm. would have been fascinating and would have put the entire film in a different perspective. It basically posits that the only way that this shell is going to work for a brain is you have to erase everything about it. Mm-hmm. You have to not just erase its past and its memories, but you have to even erase all the way down to its cultural identity. Mm-hmm. You have to take away all of it. You learn that there were 98 prior attempts to do mm-hmm. this, and she was the first successful one. And if the movie wants to talk about that, and again, you don't spend a lot of time on mm-hmm. it, but if the movie would like to talk about that,
yeah.
it would have put an amazing, fascinating, thought-provoking spin on this whole conversation.
But
this
idea of
whitewashing.
You still have been able to garner this idea from what was presented,
yes,
though.
But the idea is all it is an excuse to set up an action sequence and to have a really offensive hug at the end of the movie. And that's the only reason that this twist exists. They threw it in, and it feels like the twist is thrown in there as sort of as a reaction to the backlash, that they suddenly wrote this at the last second and said, okay, if we write it this way, people that are getting mad at us for this casting, they're now going to look at the movie in a whole new way, and they're going to realize we're being respectful of the source material and the character and all this sort of stuff. Mm. But instead, it just feels like a knee-jerk reaction to what the controversy was. And they don't put any thought behind it.
Mind blown.
They come up with the idea, but there's no thought driving it. And because there's no thought driving it, it just becomes even more offensive than if they would have just let things be, if they wouldn't have even just said anything.
So ultimately, there is no spoon.
There is no spoon. Hmm. And
so Sarah keeps calling it a twist. Mm-hmm. It's not a twist. It's just a scene in a movie where it has no real bearing on anything, which I agree with that part. But it just happens. Honestly, during the movie, at that point, I just sort of resigned to the casting, went right over my head. Now, I've heard Sarah bring this up several times. I'm like, okay, whatever, Sarah. That said, it finally clicked with me a little bit because I read a Hollywood Reporter article, I think yesterday, where they
basically posited the same thing.
Well, they took four Asian actresses or Asian people in the industry to go watch the movie, and they were like, yeah, that was really strange. That was really uncomfortable. So I guess as a white guy, it's still not completely clicking with me, but obviously it's upsetting to some. And again, it is just a stupid.
So this is a Hollywood film. Do you think middle America is going to care that this has happened?
I don't think middle America is going to care that much. Yeah. And I don't mean to stereotype middle America. I don't think the average white person even is going to be aware of this controversy or is going to think about it. Right. We're here in liberal Seattle. We like to get really excited about this. That said, you know,
but
it's very glaring to minorities and, you know, so.
And it has affected things. I mean, I don't think the movie would have, I think this whole deal did affect the film's box office performance.
Well, and the thing is that the film is targeted at a fan base that is traditionally Japanese or Asian or
geeky who
are aware
like
of
this stuff and are aware of it. You know, had the movie not been set in Japan, I'm wondering if it would have bothered me as much. Hmm. I mean, right now there's this huge controversy about Death Note. It's a Netflix film that's based on another Japanese manga and another hugely popular Japanese series of films and television shows and whatnot. But it's set here in Seattle. It's directed by Adam Wingard. And the protagonist has been changed to a white teenager. I get what everybody's angry about. I understand it. But at the same time, they've taken the story and shifted it to a completely different location. Mm-hmm. So I'm willing to at least watch the film and see if it works and give it the benefit of the doubt before I suddenly pass judgment on it.
Right.
You know, I watched this.
So it's getting the Ring treatment, basically.
Well, essentially, except but unlike The Ring, which came out when it did, in this kind of, you know, there wasn't a lot of the internet wasn't what it was, Twitter wasn't what it was, all this sort of stuff. This one is getting instant backlash before it even has a chance to show itself.
Hmm. I think changing the location, I think people have to temper their tantrums a little bit because, I mean, you have The Departed, which was based on,
Infernal Affairs, a Korean film.
Yeah. You know, it's like stories are taken from different parts of the world, remade. You know, sometimes you can say, well, is a remake necessary? But, you know, I've seen Asian films that are based on American films, and they have Asian actors. I mean, you recreate films and stories for your local audience. Now,
I think it's fair, like in the case of something like Death Note, I think it's fair to say that in a city as culturally diverse as Seattle, especially with such a huge Asian population, you could probably have cast that film better.
Okay.
But I'm still willing to give the movie the doubt and watch it.
Okay. So, Ghost in the Shell.
It's a skip for me.
Skip from Sarah.
Yeah.
Eric, how about you?
Visually, I'd say it deserves to be seen on the big screen, but I'm going to go rental. Okay. It's entertaining enough.
Okay. So, splitting the squabblers on Ghost in the Shell, taking a look back also at Going in Style, two rentals, one skip from the squabblers. Talking about Raw, we've got two theaters, one rental, and Zookeeper's Wife. It's the trifecta. We got a theater, we got a rent, and we got a skip. This is Car 54. Sarah, what are you working on?
I've got a big interview with Walter Hill that I'm going to be putting up on the website on Friday. It's also going to be in the Seattle Gay News. It's about his new movie called The Assignment, and he basically started interviewing me halfway through the movie.
Tricky.
I mean, halfway through the interview, which was bizarre.
Tricky. A little exit through the gift shop style.
A little bit. I was the first transgender film critic that he had talked to, and his movie is a very hot-button film as far as trans issues are concerned.
Okay. And Eric, anything you got on the hopper?
Nothing too exciting. Just movie review after movie review after movie review. Saw Gifted last night with you, Adam, and have some others coming up.
All right. So filmjabber.com. We can find out more there, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Very good. Well, this is Cinema Squabble, episode number 54. Thanks much for spending your time with us. And thanks much if you get the chance to head over to iTunes, head over to our website, cinemasquabble.com. And if you, by the way, if you happen to see somewhere on the site, maybe a click here for Viagra. Yes, we were hacked this week.
Oh,
the Russians have found us. I've gone through with a fine tooth comb trying to catch all of the little bombs that are there. Thanks, Russia. Way to go, Putin on the Ritz. We'll try and keep our eyes on this in the future. But we always do appreciate the thumbs up and the likes. So cinemasquabble.com has all that. You can also find us on Stitcher and iTunes. And thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer.